Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Twin Ports are home to many talented writers. In the next hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 8th Annual Writers Read, and this year's theme is all about gut instinct. This year, around 20 writers were chosen to read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland on Friday, January 26th. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, Gut Instinct.
I'm Janet Christie, and I live in Gurnee. Back when I was in college, I enrolled myself in a creative writing class. I assumed in my 18-year-old wisdom that with my well-read creative mind, I would have lots to write about. Apparently not. To say I sucked at that class is putting it mildly. Not one original thought all semester. Now at my advanced age, I realize that creativity, at least for me, is the least helpful of muses for writing. What I needed was a long, happy life with eventful happenings, eccentric spouses, memorable coworkers, hilarious relatives, friends, and neighbors. Oh, and I had to switch from creative writing to nonfiction for obvious reasons. My main intent at this point in my life is to stay upright long enough to write all the goofy stories about those people I just mentioned that I can possibly remember, and payback is hell. To put this piece of nonfiction in time, you need to know that the new baby I speak about is now 36 years old, with boys of his own, and is suffering chronically from the mother's curse. This is entitled Harry and the Baby Blanket. I quickly strip off my vomited upon shirts and shorts and toss them, along with my newborn's soggy onesie, on the floor in front of the clothes washer. I do these tasks awkwardly and with one hand, because with the other I'm holding tightly onto a slippery, almost naked 14-day-old infant. My not yet fully baked son had just finished the most recent of his every hour nursing stints when his tiny tummy decided it couldn't cope. He forcefully upchucked his liquid meal all over himself and me, his poor tired mom. Motherly instinct at this point has me snagging on the return trip to the sofa a tiny Auntie Vicky produced newborn-sized flannel blanket with which to cover the poor baby. Even though it's a warm mid-September day, baby and I are both quite wet. And soggy pretty much describes most of the first year of motherhood. The baby's frustrated howls finally subside as he begins to nurse again. And it's only a little bit after noon. With the new mother's absolute tiredness and my baby safely snuggled up with me on the sofa, I doze off to sleep. I'm not asleep long, however. I'm jerked awake by the sound of a vehicle's tires scraping to a stop in the gravel driveway of our rural home. Through my curtainless windows, I can just see the back of our white vehicle. Even though I haven't put on any fresh clothing, or for that matter, any clothing, since my husband is expected home from delivering mail at any moment, I don't give this arrival a second thought. I hear foot stomping on the welcome mat by the outside entrance, but the face at the cross-hatched window pane of the kitchen door is not that of my husband. Standing there is an 82-year-old neighbor, Harry, who is still very spry and quite current on all the goings-on in our little community. So Harry has a lady friend from Hurley, and he still drives himself to Florida back and forth every year. Long retired, he's a well driller by trade, and he can still recall and recite the exact depth of every well he ever dug. Now, Harry is also as close to absolutely stone deaf as any person I have ever met. I don't believe, however, that there's anything wrong with his vision. Harry's hands are cupping his face to block out the noon sunshine as he peers through the kitchen door's window. Meanwhile, back on the sofa, I sit immobilized, holding my baby, and no doubt posting a deer in the headlights look on my face. Maybe if I remain absolutely still, he won't see us. Then I scan my immediate surroundings for some kind of camouflage. Alas, there is nowhere to hide. The assembled clothing worn between the baby and me consists of a diaper and a pair of bikini undies. The baby's size zero Pampers covers much more of him than the undies do of me. Through the window, Harry eventually makes delighted eye contact. At least I think he's looking into my eyes. Since I can't and don't rise to open the door, Harry decides to take the initiative and stroll right in. At a really good clip, too, for an octogenarian. Propelling himself toward me, he says loudly, "I've come to see that new baby that everybody's been talking about." With as much volume as I can muster in my scrunched up position, I yell at him while he's still crossing the kitchen, "Harry, I'm not dressed." But Harry can't hear me. Harry can't hear anything. And today he's on a mission. He says, while still on the move toward the living room, "I came to see that new baby." Involuntarily, I squish backwards, squeezing into a cushion crack of the sofa's back, instinctively sliding most of my baby's tiny body under a couch pillow, leaving only his fuzzy little noggin out. That way, my gut told me, I won't have to share the postage stamp of fabric that my sister made for my son during what was obviously a mental lapse when she found out I was pregnant. Never has a baby blanket felt so minuscule. Harry's striding toward me, now only a few steps to go. This must be what an imminent train wreck feels like. Gathering any residual volume, I yell as loudly as I can, "Harry, I'm not dressed." It's no use. He's right in front of me. Resignedly, I pull my tiny baby boy out from under the pillow where I'd stashed him. And now Harry has real fine viewing. Harry enjoys a good long look and says, "That's a handsome baby." Then I look up at Harry, who has his right hand extended at about my nose level. For a split second, I thought, maybe he's offering to help me stand up. Oh, God, no. But like the gentleman he is, he just wants to shake my hand to congratulate me. Yep. I gently pull my hand out from under my blankie and shake his. I stammer a weak thank you, not even trying for loud. Maybe he can read lips. Then Harry pivots to leave. On his way out the door, he turns back to me and says, quite congenially, "Think I'll come back sometime when your husband's home." Thank you. I think I was still laughing and crying alternatingly when my husband finally did get home. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Molly Hoag. I'm from Duluth, and my piece is a memoir called Late Arrival. Lying in the dark in a strange man's bed was no recipe for rest. I felt every taut muscle in my body. My mind raced through scores of ugly outcomes. Two young women arriving in Athens at midnight without lodgings had not been the smartest idea. Typical of American college students backpacking through Europe in the 70s, Patty and I made up our itinerary as we went. It was spring break during our junior year abroad in England, and by then we considered ourselves seasoned travelers. When our group tour finished in Italy, we paired up as traveling companions, purely based on our mutual desire to see Greece. We barely knew one another. Word of Corfu's rugged beauty and remote villages had spread from fellow student travelers, and we savored visions of speeding down narrow roads by moped hair flying and wind whipping our faces. An overnight ferry took us from the heel of Italy's boot to the island of Corfu on the northwestern edge of Greece. But there, a soaking rain obliterated all sense of adventure, and we shuffled around town, shivering. When the second day dawned, equally soggy, we made a split decision to move on. Athens! We dashed to the dock to catch the next ferry with only moments to spare. A late-night landing had seemed of little consequence. We didn't arrive completely clueless. Donald, a friend of my family's living in Athens, had recommended staying at the local YMCA in the center of the city. It was full, but the staff directed us to other student lodgings nearby. We arrived to find a locked gate. Stumped, we lingered on the sidewalk. "What's up, mates?" The smooth Australian accent took us by surprise. Assessing our situation, the two young men eagerly offered their assistance. "Why not just climb over the fence?" they offered. "No way," my law-abiding self thought. But with my heart pounding and their alluring foreign accents proffering encouragement, I scaled the fence to ring the doorbell. No response. The tourist police office, which promised assistance to travelers 24 hours a day, was similarly shut tight. And our only phone number for Donald was his office number. We appeared to be out of options, at least affordable options for a couple of cheap students. Our Australian pals suggested we sleep in the park. Tired and seeing no alternative, we found an inconspicuous spot near the stairs under a shelter. Spreading out on chairs and concealing our bags, we bid farewell to the Aussies and awaited sleep. Fortunately, the spring weather was mild and dry, yet slumber eluded us. An hour passed. About 2 a.m., chilly and restless, we returned to the YMCA to implore them to let us sleep on the floor. The janitor cut short our request. Even in Greek, we could understand, closed. Walking the deserted streets of Athens in the stillness of the night, lugging our bags under the dim street lamps, we headed for what we thought was a train station, pretending to do some window shopping along the way. It turned out to be a metro station, and the only place open was a shadowy, sparsely populated bar. In the wee hours of the morning, we were weary enough that when a dark-haired, slightly older guy motioned us in and offered to buy a drink, we accepted. We still had nowhere to go, but the liquor warmed our insides, and we welcomed the temporary refuge. Despite the steep language barrier, we managed rudimentary communication with our drinking partner. Grasping our situation, he mimed that we could sleep at his apartment. Warning bells certainly went off in my head, but I silenced them with a thought of shelter and a place to rest. Escorting us to an old sedan, he drove us to his place. My anxiety mounted with each passing mile. I remember nothing about the shabby dwelling except the single, narrow bed and the dawning realization that he intended us to sleep there with him. The rumpled bed covers and dubious state of cleanliness assaulted my senses, but I continued to act on dumb impulse. Fully clothed, with our bags within arm's reach on our side of the bed, we surrendered our tired bodies to the mattress. Without exchanging a single word, Patty strategically placed herself in the middle. She knew enough about me to realize that I was sexually inexperienced and naive. I had gleaned sufficient evidence to ascertain that she was already active in that department. Despite my rigid limbs, I dozed fitfully, unaware that she spent the next hour fighting off his groping hands. When our host fell into a deep sleep, no doubt fueled by his nocturnal consumption in the bar, Patty prodded me meaningfully. Holding our breath, we slipped out of bed, gathered our belongings, and silently departed. In the pre-dawn hour, it was just light enough to see. We discovered that each of us, a few hours earlier, at least had the mental fortitude to try memorizing the route to the apartment. Relying on our senses and a paper mat, we set off to put distance between us and our recent bedfellow. Daylight was advancing when we stopped to ask directions from a guard posted near the sidewalk. A glimpse of the plaque on the stone wall revealed that we had taken ourselves to the American Embassy. An ironic find when we felt in need of protection and assistance. At that moment, just getting directions sufficed. It was a long, long walk back into the center of Athens, fueled by a deep sense of shame and embarrassment on my part. I suspect Patty merely felt relief. It all seemed miles away by the time we met Donald for lunch at a sunny outdoor cafe overlooking the city. Following a censored version of our adventures, he generously offered to host us for our remaining days in Athens. Sanctuary, at last. Or so I thought. But that's another story. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Rob Ganson. I live out in the woods right in between the creek and my garden. This little poem is actually by my alter ego, Redbone Walker. But old Redbone ain't much for going to town, so he loaned it to me for the winter. It's called Requiem at Midnight. Eyes are fixed upon a single star, awash in Aurora's green neon whispers. Fog grows, creeps from frozen ground to encompass a distant car, heard dimly as a rumor of peace. A face in the door of the fallen barn watches his dead dogs frolic in the yard. Beneath the night's cold, deep cobalt skin, pockmarked and smeared with acne of fire, scars of neon waves, a stranger in my throat moans. I would pray if I were small enough, if I knew the secret name of magic, if the mighty fell. Instead, I read a poem to a single star that died 10,000 years ago. Thank you.
You're listening to Writers Read, Gut Instinct, a public reading of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry by writers living in northern Wisconsin and the Twin Ports. We'll take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Twin Ports are home to many talented writers. In the next hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 8th Annual Writers Read, and this year's theme is all about gut instinct. This year, around 20 writers were chosen to read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland on Friday, January 26th. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, Gut Instinct.
Hello, I'm Beth Palma from Washburn. My story is White Knight in Julian Bay, and it's a true story. It was a dark, stormy night, not really, not yet anyway. It was a beautiful Lake Superior evening on soft water sprinkled with dancing ripples from a warm summer breeze. I am a sailing charter captain. This particular evening, I was sailing for a charter company out of Bayfield, Wisconsin. a 3-day sail with a group consisting of 6 16-year-old boys and their 18-year-old counselor, a crew of city boys from affluent families sailing with me on a boat named Egret, a 37-foot tartan. Our first night on the water, we anchored in Presque Isle Harbor of Stockton Island, located in the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. A second boat from the charter fleet with a seasoned captain and also owner of the charter business anchored near us, Captain John. The sun ventured low on the horizon while my crew cleaned up after dinner. Captain John and I text back and forth about the evening's weather forecast. Chance of storms out of the west after midnight may or may not become severe. He wanted to know if I had any intuition about what was going to happen. I replied, "I feel we should move into Julian Bay on the east side of the island. The risk of this is swells coming in from the open waters on the big lake can make for an uncomfortable evening, resulting in a sick crew. Let's take the chance." During the glowing moment between daylight and darkness, we motored into Julian Bay. I set anchor in 16 feet of water. With my bow turned into the west, we settled in for the night. There were 3 other boats in the bay off my port side, including Captain John. At 1 in the morning, I jolted awake to the marine radio weather alarm, warning of a line of severe thunderstorms approaching from the west, with high winds recorded at 50 miles per hour and reaching my anchorage in an hour, more or less. My first thought was, I've navigated big winds before. I can handle this. With an hour to prepare, I tiptoed through the disarray of a sleeping cabin to check the anchor. The night was still and the water like glass. The air was thick with humidity and all of our hatches wide open. I woke the guys, warned them of the coming weather, and had them sleep with their life jackets. A sailboat's cabin is similar to a camper with couches making little nooks and sleeping areas. The V-berth, a private sleeping cabin, belongs to me. Dozing off in the V-berth, I was awakened by light sprinkles of rain coming through the open hatch above my head. I jumped up to close the opening and torrential rains broke loose. With the water pouring in, the boys and I fought to close the hatches. At that moment, a wall of wind and water hit us from the north and laid the heavy boat on her side. The crew, myself, and the contents of the boat scattered in tumbled chaos, soon Egret countered by laying down on her other side. Eventually, the wind from the north broke, and we settled into the storm out of the west. The boat turned into a fish on a hook and line, swimming from side to side to escape the hook. The largest young man, at over 6 feet and 200 pounds, demanded, "I'm afraid, I'm afraid." He eventually pulled his phone from his pocket and stated, "I have to watch a movie." And then proceeded to crawl into a little nook and hunkered down over his phone. Another boy hugged his knees and rocked back and forth, back and forth. I still wonder if he'll ever go out on the water again. The counselor was amazing in caring for the guys, which allowed me to focus on the boat. At this point in the storm, we held our own, and there was nothing to do but watch and wait. I sat in the companionway, the stairway into the cabin, and watched as Egret bucked back and forth on her anchor. My next concern was the 3 boats in the bay at anchor. I kept my eyes on their anchor lights, hoping they would not break free and become a collision minefield. The boats were visible because of the constant lightning circling us. At the time, all I could think was white knight. I could see the silhouette of the island shoreline, and all else was swirling white with lightning bolts and three anchor lights dancing off my port side. It became timelessly surreal sitting on Egret with these boys while dancing and spinning dreamlike into the white night. After a while, the three other boats off my port seemed to swirl around Egret. We appeared to be in the middle of the dance. I was not frightened. I was filled with awe. After some time, the air settled down, and I returned to my berth, awakened the third time at 7 a.m. by a text from my sister. Are you on the lake? I heard there was a big storm. So I climbed out of my hatch onto the deck to a sunrise over peaceful, still blue-gray waters scattered with woodland debris. I inspected Egret for damage and found it to be minimal. Captain John's boat was no longer on my port side, but had moved to my starboard side. I shouted to him on deck, asking when during the night he had pulled anchor and moved. He responded he hadn't. After returning to the dock in Bayfield, I learned 85-mile-per-hour winds had been recorded on Stockton Island the night of the storm. Each of us on the water that night has our own story to tell. Some of the boats in Presque Isle Harbor did not fare as well as we did. Some of us are still haunted by this experience, which lies deep in the gut. Thank you.
Hello. I'm Nancy Larson. I live in Marengo, and this is my first time reading at Writer's Read. It's appropriate that I follow the story about Julian Bay. My poem is called Lake Superior July. Two dogs so grateful, released from the back seat to our midweek deserted beach. The day so hot and weighted to our lake skin pushed smooth. We splash in, each to a chest-deep line from shore, spits, pointer, human. Then, low booms rumble our animal core, rise below hearing, up through the crucible of bone-cold water, ending and beginning beyond a purpling distance. Sonic waving or warning. Our lake breathes air, gestates, groans under pressure. Dogs snap their noses up, heads around, latch to my eyes. Time to go. Our connections could electrify, but we know we will never feel this, be this again. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Kyle Lanthold. I'm a student here at Northland and a writing major. My poem is titled, A Treat for All Hallows' Eve. My right hand moves with the blade, sawing back and forth, up and down around the braid, that my left hand holds to control the cut. Decayed matter soon goes soft, but there are guts that I can raid and bake for later. Put them on a pan, all laid out, like Lecter's snack. This lazy vegetable is ripe and ready to be made presentable. Facial surgery by the likes of Hannibal, me, his prodigy, to make it unforgettable with precise design. Two angry eyes, three stained teeth in one wide smile, a short, stubby nose, a tongue of flickering guile. But this new face will not last. It will rot, and deer will nibble at the eyes, past the limp, mushy skin, to taste the sweet chloroplast, their own trick-or-treat.
Hello, everybody. My name is Carol Dunbar, and this is a piece of short fiction I wrote in the middle of October, It's called In the Middle of January. Willem hadn't yet figured out how to talk to girls, but he saw her there on the swings, hunched up and alone. He'd gotten off his bike to walk it up the hill because of the snow in the road. It was only October, but they'd gotten another 2 inches sometime during the day, and he hadn't even noticed until he got on his bike. It was getting dark, the sky streaked with grays and the air still, only an occasional crow or the swish of a car throwing up slush. He wanted to go home. He was tired after practice, and she didn't know him very well, but her shoulders were shaking, wrapped up in a long white sweater. He had the feeling that if he didn't go over there and at least try to say something, he'd be breaking some kind of agreement with himself, because there she was. And even if he failed, trying was still the right thing to do. "Hey," he lifted his bike up over the curb. She lifted her face. It held an expression so raw, so revealing in the way everything sat right there. And she was spent, he thought, too exhausted to pretend anything. He brought his bike over. His football jersey and pants were tied around the frame because they smelled bad and needed washing. Over his t-shirt, he'd thrown on an old sweatshirt. "You look like you had a bad day," he said. "Haven't you heard?" "About what?" "Stupid." She sniffed, wiped a hand under her nose. "You would think..." She shook her head. "I don't know what you would think." A pink blush spread out from around her nostrils, and her eyes were wet, the pupils large and pure like pieces of green bottle beach glass. "Cal made out with Alyssa Darkling behind the gym, where everyone, including me, could see. I'm not the jealous type, I'm really not. But it's always a battle every time, and I'm just so sick of it. He says he feels the same way I do, but he doesn't act like it." The dark dash of a lone goose tracked its way above his head in the flat pewter sky. It didn't honk, but he heard the flap and whoosh of its great wings up there beating the air. Willem watched it disappear into the haze. "I don't know him very well," he said. "Cal, I mean, he seems like a decent guy, but this is just high school. There's going to be 100 other guys once you get to college, guys who will appreciate someone like you." She looked at him, and her face went very still. A piece of hair was stuck to her chin. She parted her lips. "So, you think I should break up with him?" He waited until all of the things he wanted to say passed through his mind, silent as that goose overhead. "I can't tell you what to do," he said, "but I think you deserve better." She stood up off the swing and held her arms out to give him a hug. The ends of her sweater were pulled down over her hands so they were puffy like mittens, and she patted his back with them. "Thanks," she said. "You're a good person." He thought, as she was walking out to her car, how January was really the perfect name. You could choose any of the months of the year, and they'd make for a pretty decent name. August, April, June. But January was by far the best one. The driver's side door clapped shut, her engine turned over, and January drove away. He came out of nowhere. the hulking dark figure of Cal across the practice field. He had his pad slung over his shoulders and his helmet tucked under one arm. He lifted his chin and called out. "I saw you talking to January," he said. "What did you say to her?" Willem turned his bike around so it faced the other way. The center pit of his stomach bucked, and he jumped onto the seat and pushed down hard on the pedals. "Hey," Cal shouted, "get back here! I'm talking to you!" He heard the thunk of Cal's helmet hit the ground and the staccato pounding of his running feet, and Willem was pretty certain that he had figured something out then, something that Cal hadn't figured out, which is why Cal wouldn't be catching up with him. Thank you.
You're listening to Writers Read, Gut Instinct, a public reading of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry by writers living in northern Wisconsin and the Twin Ports. We'll take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Twin Ports are home to many talented writers. In the next hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 8th annual Writers Read, and this year's theme is all about gut instinct. This year, around 20 writers were chosen to read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland on Friday, January 26th. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, Gut Instinct.
My name is Avisa Rockwell, and I live in Duluth. This is called Children of the Earth. It's a memoir. When I tell someone I grew up near Albuquerque, they'll say, "I love Breaking Bad." I'll say it was too brutal for me. And then they'll say, "Yeah, but it's brilliant." And then I'll think, "Yeah, that sounds exactly like where I grew up." I can always tell when a picture was taken in New Mexico because the blues are deep, the whites are blinding, and in midday, shadows disappear. There's no place to hide. The sun will find you. On the mesa near the house, I chased leggy jackrabbits over sagebrush and carved miniature adobes out of sand. I often uncovered a child of the earth, a gooey insect with yellow stripes on its body and a giant baby-like head. I've since learned they're called Jerusalem crickets, and they give a painful bite. Instinctively, I knew this, and I always covered them back up. I pushed sand over their bodies and played somewhere else. The bus ride to the middle school in the valley bumped alongside endless irrigation ditches, so I passed the time reading books in the deep green leather seat. My favorite author was Lois Duncan. She wrote about Albuquerque teenagers with supernatural powers and sociopathic friends. In seventh grade, a boy named Michael and I won a citywide writing contest for our school. My story was called The Reunion, and it was about kids who make a pact to return to their beloved forest in 20 years. When they return, the neighborhood bully is developing it for real estate. Michael wrote about post-apocalyptic mutant animals who murder all the normal survivors. At the writing contest reception at the Downtown Convention Center, I met Lois Duncan. She had my mother's kind eyes and Philadelphia accent. She shook my hand, gave me a certificate, and signed my book. Michael and I ignored each other. Michael was bigger than the other boys in middle school. He wore black Iron Maiden t-shirts, and he whipped his long blonde hair around with a sexy confidence like Robert Plant. His eyes were blue, ice blue and intelligent. When he looked at me, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. I think I confused this feeling with lust, an error that girls sometimes make. My friend Dottie and I prank called him in a deep, breathy voice named Cecilia. We promised to visit him late at night. He responded with a deadpan, "Oh yeah? Then what?" I was too innocent to really imagine, so I'd slam the phone down and giggle. Then she would dare me to do it again. In 1985, landlines seldom had caller ID, so I assumed that Michael never knew it was me. One day in July, Dottie suggested we visit Michael. He lived just a few blocks from her house in the paved subdivision called Paradise Hills. They used to play together as children. They actually looked alike, with eyes spaced far apart. They were daring and aloof. At 13, I thought these traits were attractive. I would learn later they were signs of fetal alcohol syndrome. With moosed hair and fringed moccasins, we walked the blazing sidewalks to Michael's house. Like us, he was an only child and spent a lot of time alone. He led us past a locked gun case to his bedroom. He played Led Zeppelin's Cashmere from his cassette deck. Dottie sat next to him on the bed and flipped her hair while I sat by his desk, silent. I decided he wasn't my type. Too heavy metal. I wanted punk. We didn't stay long. Dottie and I went back to her house to read tarot cards. My Celtic cross foretold peril, transformation, and new consciousness. Adolescence in one reading. 2 years later, ninth grade, Dottie ran away with her transgender boyfriend. For 3 months, she was a missing child. On Christmas morning, she called me collect from Haight Street in San Francisco. I did not recognize her voice. She sounded like an adult, and she spoke of adult things. At that time, I was seeing a Navajo, or now Dene, goth, whose brother was Michael's best friend. While goth boy and I made out on his twin bed, Michael sat on the other, carved an apple, loaded it with pot, and kindly offered us a hit. We said, "No, thank you." A year later, 10th grade, Michael took LSD with another friend, unlocked his father's gun cabinet, and crept down the hallway to where his parents slept. What happened next, I want to be too innocent to imagine. Oddly enough, Michael went to school the next day. I saw him by my locker. His stare pulled in everything around him like a black hole. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up. But this time, I kept walking. The next day, I stayed home sick, as I was often that year. At 3 p.m., the phone rang with big news. Cops surrounded the school, pulled Michael out of class, handcuffed him, and read him his rights. He had thrown a party the night before, and we knew kids who went. They drank from a keg, fondled his guns, and he told them to stay out of the backyard. In the morning, the neighbor peeked over the cinder block wall and saw two freshly dug mounds. That's when he called the cops. That night I was sick for real, followed by a queasiness that lasted for months. It rises again from time to time in the presence of certain people, in certain places. I've learned to trust it. They aren't butterflies. Maybe Jerusalem crickets. Michael was locked up for 20 years and was just arrested again for imitating the baddest on Breaking Bad. But he still roams free in my dreams. In one, he calls my cell phone. He asks for Cecilia.
Hi, I'm Lucy Amundsen. I gained a lot of weight during my pregnancy. A lot. It was a somewhat complicated one during which not once was I accused of glowing. 84 pounds can do that to a gal. But to my surprise, my massive maternity became an invitation for open commentary. Sometimes just as startled, "Oh my God," as I unexpectedly rounded a corner. Or the kind observation, "Christmas baby dear?" To which I was forced to answer, "Actually June," a date 7 months away. To accommodate our growing family, I waddled through open houses until we found the beige rambler of my dreams. With thick plaster walls in an award-winning school district, Jason and I plan to watch our children grow up in this suburban womb while we gracefully aged in the safety of one-floor living. The ink was still wet on our closing papers when Jason's phone rang. He picked up, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir. See you Tuesday, sir." And just like that, he was literally called up. The rules had changed in our post-9/11 reality, and the National Guard unit he thought he was separated from was now sending him to in process. And in a matter of days, he was packed up and gone. He was to serve a domestic deployment, a very good deal. But then it sunk in. I'm hugely pregnant. I have a 2-year-old daughter and would now be moving without my husband. At this new base, Jason walked across acres of empty fields and snowstorms, hand aloft, looking for cell phone signal to get helpful messages from me like, "I guess that free master's wasn't as free as you thought it was." One Friday, after a lengthy ultrasound appointment, I felt the exquisite pain of an abscessed tooth beating in rhythm with my pulse. And after connecting with my dentist answering service, I resigned myself to 2 hellish days of solo parenting a boisterous toddler while negotiating the habit trail pass of the boxes in our new home. And side note, Tylenol sucks. But after 3 nights of fitful sleep, I opened an eye, and it's Monday, the day of my dentist appointment. And then I hear the unmistakable scrape of the snowplow going by, and I close that eye again to perchance dream that I am not me. Out in the garage, I look from corner to empty corner and back again. Jason, whose one job it was to pack the garage, neglected to bring snow shovels to the new house in January. I left him this phone message. "You are a captain, a logistics officer in the United States Army, and I fear for the safety of this nation." I am not missing this appointment. Finding a hammer, I go into our new home office and madly whack and whack at one of Jason's bookshelves until I loosen a flat piece of wood. And as I dig out our Honda Accord, my little daughter is standing on a snowbank cheering me on, "Go, Mama, go, Mama, go!" An hour late, but finally in the chair, my dentist gave me an automatic, "Hello, how are you?" I take the question to heart and burst into tears. Tools in her lap, she calmly waits for the sobbing woman in the chair to compose herself. And obviously, she's in the health field, and this is not a big deal, and I choose to believe this. Finishing her exam, my dentist announced that I do not have an abscessed tooth, but rather a simple bruised nerve from intensely clenching my jaws. I protest, describing the blooming pain, and all but demand my well-deserved root canal. "No," she assured me, "it's just contact pressure. She's going to file the teeth so they no longer connect with the damage area." Her assistant, chatting over the volley of drills, says, "I've never seen damage like this." And my dentist answers, "This is more a condition you see in the mentally ill." "Hey," I think, "I'm right here." It's not like I'm out or anything. So So while I'm entertaining the idea that maybe I actually am crazy, the dentist interrupts my thoughts and says, "Are you having twins?" I get this question all the time, and I gack out an answer from between her gloved fingers, and I say, "No, it's actually a tumor." And as I say it, I remember this truth too intense. I instinctively packed it down in my gut, but I recall now the funny sonogram screen, the wing-haired technician who resembled Farrah Fawcett, who between gum snaps told me horror stories about conditions just like this one. And then I also remember my parents phoning to tell me that my mom's no longer in remission, and this time her cancer is aggressive, and I am to look it all up on the computer, but currently my World Wide Web is residing in a moving box, and I'm several phone calls away from anything close to the internet. And I remember that nestled against my yet-to-be-born baby boy is a fibroid tumor, his exact weight and size, which pose a host of issues, and that I haven't told anybody, not my family, not my deployed husband, not my midwife, just my dentist. All right. This all works out, by the way. Thank you.
That's it for our program. You can hear it again online at wpr.org/superior. Join us again next week for more stories and poetry from writers across northern Wisconsin and the Twin Ports. You've been listening to Writers Read Gut Instinct. The event is produced by Northland College in partnership with Wisconsin Public Radio and Aqueous Magazine. I'm Danielle Kading. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.